But I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at The Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings. Tuesday evenings at The Modern is a weekly program, lecture program. I think many of you are familiar, but those who are not, you may have noticed tonight it's free and open to the public, something I'm quite proud of being associated with, can't take credit for, but can associate with. And this fall, we run through November 19th. The lineup, I think, is quite exceptional. Much of it relates to the Mexico Inside Out exhibition, but as with tonight's lecture, there are a few throughout that are not directly related with that and probably more in keeping with our usual lineup. But we had to take advantage of such a spectacular show and so many artists. You can find the listing with descriptions of each of the lectures on The Modern's website, and I encourage you to do that. There are also rack cards outside if you just need something to remind you of dates and names. Tonight, we have the great fortune of having Chicago-based artist, curator, and art writer, Michelle Grabner, here with us to share her immense insights into all things art and perhaps beyond. If you read the announcement for tonight's presentation, you know that I described Michelle as a dynamic force who has been at the fore of the art world with her ambitious and varied initiatives for some time, which I wrote with absolute confidence given Michelle's superwoman-like persona. With a BA in painting and drawing and an MA in art history from the University of Wisconsin, and then going on for an MFA in art theory and practice from Northwestern University, Michelle is a writer for significant publications including Art Forum, Frieze, Modern Painter, Extra, and Art Agenda, to name a few. She is professor and chair of painting and drawing at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She's senior critic for Yale University in painting and printmaking, and believe it or not, with all of that, the curator of the upcoming 2014 Whitney Biennial. Which really doesn't come as a surprise, because why wouldn't you want somebody with that kind of talent to curate the Whitney Biennial? With her husband, Brad Killam, Michelle has, for the past 14 years, run the space The Suburban, which is a highly successful, small, and ambitious artist project space behind the couple's Chicago home. And as if that wasn't enough to do in addition to what you're required to do as an artist and a professor and a writer and such, they have now more recently purchased and renovated the former Waupaca. Very good. I can't believe I got that right. Waupaca County Poor Farm, which was built in 1876 and is in Little Wolf, Wisconsin. That space is to facilitate and present artist projects and to conduct seminars and think tanks. There's really just no stopping them. In addition to all of this, Michelle is a thoughtful and productive artist represented by a number of galleries, including Rocket Gallery in London, Shane Campbell Gallery in Chicago, Green Gallery in Milwaukee, Gallery 16 in San Francisco, and Anne Mossery Marleo, something like that, in Zurich. And I think more recently, she's with Jim Cohen now in New York. She has a traveling survey exhibition. I want to emphasize a traveling survey exhibition of her work titled I Work From Home, organized by the Museum of Contemporary Art in Cleveland, which opens this fall, November 1st. So notice the time frame here. She has agreed to be here tonight while her survey exhibition opens in a month, and she is preparing as curator for the most anticipated and scrutinized exhibition in this country and perhaps the world. And in that position as curator for the Whitney, Michelle is quite possibly the first to identify principally as an artist, which is, I think, is of note in and of itself. Her friend and mentor, David Robbins, speaks to her unique contribution, explaining, quote, "Michelle wears a lot of hats, but she's an artist first and last." Artists have a different agenda than do curators, a different relation to history. So with Michelle's participation as curator of the Whitney Biennial, we may see a greater openness to artists who have independently developed valuation systems and uses for art that depart from those reinforced by academy and the marketplace. In short, Michelle Grabner and her endeavors are the culmination of what the art world needs and seems to be longing for: compassion, initiative, and determination without asking permission. I suspect we have a lot to learn from tonight from Michelle's presentation titled "The Center Doesn't Hold." So with that, please join me in welcoming Michelle Grabner.
Welcome, everybody. I want to know who this person is that you introduced, because it's not me. When the activities are listed, I don't understand them. So I'm going to go through with you ideas. I'm going to go through some of my projects. But overall, I want you to think about it. Don't think this is pretentious, but how I ended up being in front of you all tonight, but also influence. How did I acquire influence? When, you know, I'm kind of a regular gal from the Midwest, born and raised in Wisconsin, very middle class. I just work very hard. I'm very curious. Sometimes I'm very diligent and dutiful. Sometimes I'm rigorous, but mostly I work hard. Jonathan Franzen, who is, as we all know, recognized and celebrated fiction author, recently came up with a recent essay, and it kind of explains a little bit his poo-pooing of the young and the hip. But he was talking about the difference between, and using it as a metaphor, between Mac and PC. And although I do have a Mac, I'm really a PC person. It really is about the work that's being done. It's just not about the kind of the slickness of owning it. That's not me. It really is about the work that's being done. So, you know, despite Terry's lovely introduction and that list of things, you know, I woke up this morning, packed a lunch for my husband and my daughter, had a bit of an argument because she was late, and I just, you know, it's really, that's where my head is at any given time. And then many things came in from New York between, you know, Chicago and here that I had to deal with. So there'll be plenty of time to ask questions at the end. Please do ask questions. And ask me, impress me a little bit about the biennial. There's some things I can talk about the biennial, some things I can't, but I will do my very best to be accommodating. But a dangerous way to start off these lectures, but I'm going to, is talking about boredom. You know, not to anticipate that the lecture itself will be boring, but I don't, that'll be up to you. And fair warning, I talk fast. But the concept of boredom is pretty interesting, and it's actually pretty prominent right now, even in academia. You know, it's one of these things where, because we don't have it, contemporary culture, our context doesn't make time for boredom. If we're bored, and profoundly bored, devastatingly bored, we seek help. We seek medication for the most part. The only, you know, the only people who are allowed to be bored is, you know, my 8-year-old. And, you know, even then she will complain about being bored. But what happens in that time? I think it's really interesting. Not only in terms of context, contemporary culture that I'm talking about for all of us, but within my own work. It's a place where one is not consuming, right? One is not looking for distraction. And that is something that we constantly are doing. That is something that these bigger forces, whether we call it capital or whether we call it something else, whether we call it media, is really always trying to push us to. Being bored is a problem. But, you know, I want you to think about that. What happens in that time, in that place where one can have a kind of reflection? So keep that in mind as I go through it, particularly when I get to my work. Boredom in painting is often reflected in this book, a Boclin painting, looking out into the distance, looking out, you know, beyond. And here we have, you know, Odysseus, you know, bored with too much sex on an island, right? At some point, too much. He has to look out. He has to look beyond. Or a pre-aphulite like Millet, the idea that it's in the body, that boredom somehow is embodied in the anatomy, in this case kind of arcing back in this painting called Autumn, and the kind of reflection of seeing time go by. But to be able to see time going by means you have control of time. And ask yourself, Are you in control of your time, your day-to-day? I often feel like I'm not. So, yes, given some of these things that happen to be on my plate for this year, you know, this year will come to an end, or, you know, March when the biennial opens will come to an end, how can one actually take control, or at least be self-aware or reflexive of time? So boredom, think about it as an overarching theme and something not to be disparaging. I don't want to disparage boredom, the idea of control of time. When I get to my work, I'll talk about it a little bit more. And then also the studio, the site of the studio, particularly for we artists. What does the studio mean? A handful of years ago now, 2010, I co-published a book called The Studio Reader with a colleague of mine, Mary Jane Jacobs, published by the University of Chicago Press, that really looked at the studio. And it was an idea that actually came up earlier than that, in 2008, right before the market crash, when money was really governing discourse in contemporary art, whether it was in the academy where I teach, my students wanted to talk about money, collectors were controlling the discourse. It was very frustrating as an artist. So where does an artist go? Where does an artist have authority? And that is in the studio, back to the studio. So when Mary Jane, my colleague at the School of the Art Institute, approached me, I said, well, let's look at the studio. Let's look at it closely. And since then, if you Google, you know, studio texts, many, many, many of them will come up. So it's becoming fetishized in a little bit. Initially, I just want to say that it really was a pushback to, again, a kind of a commercial stronghold that overtook the art world again, and still today, we perfectly well know that that the economy, the art world economy, really is strong. And we'll talk about those value systems in a little bit as well. So I'm just going to kind of walk through some different kind of a studio scenarios, studio projects. And this is one that you may be familiar with. It's Bruce Nauman's Fat Chance, John Cage, where he actually put an infrared camera in his studio and wanted to document what happens at night. So the studio is this mystical place. What happens when he's not there, you know, working? Well, you know, the rats come out, the cats get the feast. So this other kind of activity happens. But again, it's night. We can't see it unless we have the special equipment. So it really is kind of mystifying what goes on. Or Francis Bacon, the idea, we see institutions now actually recreating studios and transplanting them into the institution themselves. So we have here Francis Bacon's studio, which was in Chelsea, London, transplanted to Hugh Lane Gallery in Ireland, in Dublin. And you can't see it, right? You have to kind of walk around, look through the glass. So again, you're kind of contoured, but you see again this kind of romantic studio, this guy, you know, so embedded in, the paint, the materiality of it, that there can be no control. That control is almost lost within that. So really perpetuating the myth of the romantic studio. So institutions are involved in that as well. Here we have Donnell Wolford. Donnell Wolford is a fictional artist. She doesn't exist. There's a couple actresses who actually play her. Donnell Wolford is an avatar of Joe Scanlon. Joe Scanlon is a New York-based artist. He is chair of the art department at Princeton University. So Donnell, if you go to her website, she has a timeline. She's represented by a commercial gallery in New York, Wall Space. So Donnell is tricky because Joe Scanlon is a white male, and Donnell is a black female. And representation is hotly contested within institutions, within the contemporary art world, and that's something we can talk about later in terms of thinking about the biennial. I'm thinking about it all the time. The institutions are thinking about it all the time. And as opposed to embracing it, maybe they shield their eyes from it. So it's a very tricky thing. Donnell, the idea of a fictional artist in a fictional studio who can make fictional things. So again, think about Joe Scanlon here. Creates an artist who gets to make things that he's not typically known for, right? So how does one expand one's practice? Well, you create another artist. You create another studio. David Robbins, who Terry nicely quoted, a friend and an important artist, somebody who worked for Warhol back in the 80s, and now back in Milwaukee after all these years, whose studio is actually his study, where he works off the computer. He just has, you know, a handful of computers, does a lot of film video work for the most part. So the idea that the study, of course, can be the studio. Or de Kooning. This is de Kooning's studio. It's a photograph from 1983. And here you have de Kooning, you know, working on one of his later paintings. But de Kooning, coming from a middle-class situation, being a Dutch man, decided that there was something uncomfortable about the huge amount of wealth he was acquiring as a celebrity artist, as an artist of note, international note. So what he would do is take a lot of that money and dump it into a studio, a spectacular studio, where he had promenades that he could be up above and look at the work and so forth. And you can see the way the brushes are laid out and so forth. So somebody kind of taking those resources and putting it back into a place that he values. Rochelle Feinstein. Rochelle Feinstein is an artist based in New York. She's also chair of the painting and drawing department at Yale University. She's been around for a long time and in and out of the art world in interesting ways, never angry about it, but always putting a lens on it, being quite critical of the fashion of artists and as they fall in and out. But what I like about this particular piece of Rochelle's is here's a painting of storage, right? So studios pragmatically are about storage. We make things, they may go out into the world, but for the most part, for most of us, they come back, right? So we have to be the steward of our own work. How do we take care of it? Is it a failure that it comes back? Of course not. Sometimes our work stays out there. So the idea of thinking about the studio as a place of storage, a place where we have to care for our own work, and think about it over the long form, the long arc. It's not a matter that it went out, it went to a show, it wasn't purchased, it's back. Maybe it'll get placed someday, maybe it won't, but we have to be able to see that possibility. So the studio, I think about the suburban as an extension of the studio to a certain degree. It's a bit of dangerous thinking. The suburban is this place that we've run for 14 years outside of our home in Oak Park, which is a first ring suburb of Chicago. Oak Park is known for its Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. Frank Lloyd Wright set up his home and studio in Oak Park, which is pretty remarkable. It was at the turn of the century, and Frank Lloyd Wright, prior to that, would take the train downtown, work for Louis Sullivan, as most men did, but the idea that the suburbs offered him something. The suburbs at that point were a place where women raised kids. But embedding himself in that situation, embedding himself in ideas of pedagogy, in a kind of space, in a kind of landscape, and thinking about the domestic is really quite interesting. We don't live in that posh area where Frank Lloyd Wright is in Oak Park, but it's close by, and I'd like to bring him up. And I'll talk a little bit about Frank Lloyd Wright when I talk about Froebel and some of the tenets of kindergarten and the vocabulary that comes with it. So the idea of home and studio and that collapse is still there. And I'm going to walk you through some of the exhibitions. We opened a show on Sunday, this past Sunday, and it's an artist-run space. We don't sell things. And we've showed people, and I'll walk you through some of the work, but Luke Toymans, you may recognize Luke Toymans as a prominent Belgian painter of note, and then artists right out of school from all over the place. In the past, we haven't, it's tricky because a place like this that's been running for such a long time and one is so embedded in the politics of Chicago, it's very difficult to show Chicago artists without showing a kind of favoritism, whether it's with your colleagues or whether it's with former students. So the idea for the suburban is to bring in artists, whether they're from Fort Worth or St. Louis or Minneapolis or London or Sydney, and to actually bring in these practices that give context to Chicago-based artists. So they're small spaces. This is an example of one of our openings, and I would say that 80% of the people who come to see our shows will come to our Sunday openings. We have two exhibition spaces and a third space, which is run by Shane Campbell. It's a commercial gallery, so he has a project space out there. The space 10 by 10 feet and 10 by 20 feet, very small little gestures. And I'm going to walk you through a little bit of a historical arc. This goes way back and kind of speaks to some of the influences of the suburban. Dave Muller, you might know Dave Muller, a prominent artist based in Los Angeles. So Dave Muller, when he was working for Mike Kelly years and years ago, would create this. He had this project called 3-Day Weekend. So basically, when he'd travel around and install Mike Kelly's work, what Dave would end up doing is bringing work from LA of his mates, whether that's Ingrid Kalam or Laura Owens, and installing that work in a location where Mike was having his shows. And it was called 3-Day Weekend. They would last for all of 3 days or the length of the duration that Dave was there setting up all work. So we invited Dave to do 3-day weekend, and what you're looking at here is just that. So that backdrop, that green wall, is actually a canvas by the artist Galen Gerber. Galen Gerber is a colleague of mine, and he just pushed, we were just on a panel at Expo Chicago, an art fair in Chicago, and he pushed back at me when I told him that his practice, I didn't call it parasitic, but it's a platformist practice, right, where he hosts other work on top of his work. And some people see it as perhaps parasitic if you start thinking about authorship, right? If you hang a Sherry Levine on Galen Gerber's canvas, which he has, or put a David Hammons in front of it, which he has, he acquires some of that narrative, some of that artist's work, their ideas, but also, you know, their kind of authority within the art world. So some people will see that perhaps as parasitic, kind of pulling on, you know, riffing off, sucking some of that notoriety from those artists he works with. The other side of the coin is very different, and that is something that, you know, maybe the suburban is as well, a platformist position, and that is a position of generosity, creating a place in which one can host another artist's gesture, another artist's work, and kind of creating something that happens. So it's not just on the white wall, it's actually on a canvas painted gray. And here what you see is Sam Durant. This is some language text that Sam Durant sent along with David Mueller, insisting that he get some sleep over this 3-day weekend, and then it was painted right on Galen's backdrop. So Galen's backdrop, because they are architectural, kind of function as walls, they also kind of move through time in an interesting way. So there could be something that, you know, his show was up, this canvas was up in the previous show, and then it ended up in this show as well, and then the show in addition to that. So you have this kind of protraction of time as well. In the front, you see, this is very interesting. I thought it was quite a brave move for Dave Mueller. And this is 1999, where Dave Mueller asked his dealers, Blum & Poe, a powerhouse of dealers, two dealers who run a gallery called Blum & Poe in Los Angeles, to create this table. And there's a little riff of a John Wesley painting on it, so you can kind of recognize that motif as well. And then the file folders are the catalog. This is a more recent exhibition, so you can kind of get a sense. The house is to the right. You can't really see it, but you can see the kind of original suburban, the cinder block cube for the most part. You see some text wrapped around it. That's by Lars Breuer, a Dusseldorf-based artist. And then you see the building in the background. My studio's upstairs, and then there's the two gallery spaces downstairs. So this is kind of small potatoes, you guys. I mean, this is not big exhibition spaces. It's all funded within, you know, the household economy. We have barbecues on Sundays and so forth. So it's not, you know, it's not a lot of real estate. But what's important to know, and I hope all young artists hear this, it's kind of like sticking with it, 14 years. So if you ever come and visit Chicago, and maybe some of you are from Chicago, will understand the Chicago landscape. We don't have a lot of commercial galleries. We have a couple. You know, they do fine. But it really is about these independent spaces, these alternative spaces. Each one of my students, as if it is a prerequisite, opens up a space in their garage, in their front room. We've had them in mailboxes. We had them in purses. We had them in the back of pickups. I mean, I cannot tell you. You can't keep up with them. They pop up and they go away. And it's interesting. And for the most part, you know, they're showing their work. They're showing their friends' work. And maybe they start to network with another city and they start to fold those artists into that space. That's what Chicago is, and we do it well. We don't expect young artists to always stay in Chicago. Many of them, upon graduation or giving Chicago 2 years upon receiving an MFA, will go to New York or go to Los Angeles. That happens pretty regularly. We get this bleed off. But that, again, is not to lament. It's just the reality of, again, being a second city. But the result is these kind of interesting spaces that happen. What's curious, though, and something that that a lot of young artists, and I tell this to students, but it's very hard for it to kind of bed in, and that is the expectation that they ran the space in Chicago will translate when they move the Bushwick into something interesting to the commercial galleries. So if you go to Green Neftali, and a very good commercial gallery in Chelsea, and say, you know, I had the space, I had my own shows there, it means nothing to New York. It means nothing to the commercial system. And it takes a long time to understand that you have to build your own criteria into what these are. You can't expect it to parlay into a different stage, or even a different system if it's the commercial system versus the not-for-profit system. How I have done it, I've done it with my husband, is because we've done it for 15 years, right? It's over this time. And why have we done it for 15 years? Well, I have three kids, and they all go through the public school systems in Oak Park, right? So we're tied to a place. We're tied to a family system, a relationship to schools, a relationship to raising kids, which, again, is very different than a lot of the grad students or students who are coming out of the many programs in Chicago. So because of that, being able to identify, you know, our life, our value, and be able to kind of fold art into that, it made a lot of sense for us. And then we just stuck with it. We worked really hard. And, you know, over this now 15 years, you know, you kind of fall in and out of it. It becomes interesting. It becomes not interesting. You know, as the art world changes, you understand, you know, how valuable this is or where it's not valuable anymore. But you really kind of got to watch it and map it regularly. But more importantly, you have to, you know, build in its own criteria. You know, this is not a strategy for me to get a gallery in New York. You know, this is not a strategy for me to get a survey show. It really is about coming to know artists. Every 6 weeks, they come to our house, they live with us. You know, we don't offer that much. Maybe I tried to get them a visiting artist gig, but it helps me keep apprised on a firsthand basis of what other artists are doing elsewhere. I'll just go through some real quick examples. This is Ethan Breckenridge. Dealing with social spaces, obviously, and the idea that, you know, the small little space confuses people when they come out for openings, because it's always this other kind of hospitality going on in the yard. So, and then Sean Dack made a tape, what was it called? A soundtrack for Drinking Coffee By, I think, obviously, in relationship to the coffee maker. And this is also Ethan's piece. This is, he ended up doing both spaces and created, again, I'll talk about Tony Farron a little bit, but just these kind of cut tubes of aluminum, these things that you would pick up at the Home Depot, building supply and creating this kind of beautiful system, this kind of filigree, and put it outside the gallery. Rare occasion when artists, I'll give you a little backstory really quick, just a little anecdote. What I was doing is inviting, because we have two spaces, I'd invite two artists. But, you know, artists don't always know each other, nor do they get along. You know, artists have particular egos. So what I ended up doing is, yeah, we had an incident, and it was fine, but I didn't want to deal with it again. So what I ended up doing is inviting an artist who then would invite the person that they would want to show with or be in the other space. So that solved itself just fine. And this is the case where I invited Waleed Beshti, and Waleed invited Jim Welling, a photographer based in New York. And here's Waleed, you know, cleaning up after he installed his glass boxes. And a little bit about these glass boxes, if you're not aware or haven't seen this project. It's a kind of great project, and obviously riffing on minimalism, but also just, you know, the thingness that we deal with. We make things, we ship things. And what happens is that, you know, they break and it's a disaster. But in this case, it becomes, these works become more valuable as he ships them around the country for exhibitions where they break. They end up becoming, increase their value. So that's what's going on here. And you can see the Waleed photograph, the Jim Welling photographs in the background. They're photographs of the Farnsworth House, which is an exquisite piece of Philip Johnson architecture outside of Chicago. And why I want to talk about these guys is they actually integrated their work. So often artists, even though they know each other, even though, you know, I invite you to come and do a show contemporaneous with my show, everybody takes their space. They go to the corner. Here's a performance. I was talking about Danelle Wolford earlier, the fictional artist. Here is Danelle giving a performance at the Suburban. And you can see Danelle's objects, paintings on the wall. So Danelle, you know, creates these. They're on canvas. That's what's really interesting. So they are paintings, and they have the authority of painting because they're on stretchers. But what's on top of those linen stretchers are pieces of wood, you know, scrap stuff that one would find on the studio floor. And again, Joe, the artist who invented Danelle, can't really make those paintings. That, if you look at his work, that's not part of the economy of his work. So again, by inventing Danelle, he's able to kind of branch out into a different formal and material territory, as well as creating all kinds of political problems in terms of identity. So the Suburban, again, we're resourceful. And here we have Katerina Grossa, who was in town installing in the two spaces and pulling on my grad students at the time to come help and mix paint. We had another artist from Madison who transformed one of the spaces into a two-seater tiki bar, which my boys were in middle school at the time and quite loved this piece. And then the glowing television was played It's a Wonderful Life again and again. This is a piece by Tony Fair. I'm going to bring Tony Fair up again because I think he's an extraordinary artist in terms of transforming everyday materials into something quite exquisite and formal. So Tony came to visit us right after he was participating in the Manifesto or the Istanbul Biennial? I don't recall. And spent a couple weeks with us. And, you know, this is simple blue painter's tape, right? So we get it. But what was interesting is when you look at it, you get the kind of perpendicular configuration of the tape. You know, it glows. It's beautiful. There's something Byzantine about it. But at the same time, it's important to know that he was out in this cold little space in December for a handful of days reconfiguring, repositioning, recomposing this tape. So what looks almost random and kind of built and kind of immediate to us, he very carefully composed. This was a crazy piece. A young woman who I never worked with, ironically, she's the woman who has the gallery called Clutch, which is in a bag, a little handbag. Now, her name is Meg Duguid. She graduated from the School of the Art Institute in Sculpture, and approached me after receiving her MFA and said, you know, I never worked with you, but, you know, I have this idea. I want to pitch this to you. She said, you know how much tuition we students pay, and it's abstract. It's something absurd, and I could never afford to go to school at the school that I teach. She said, so as a way of kind of taking back, I stole toilet paper. I stole a lot of toilet paper when I was there. Every time I had the opportunity, I would, you know, tuck a roll. So she said, I would like to come out with some friends in a truck with all of this toilet paper and completely toilet paper the house. And it was exquisite. It was beautiful. It dissolved the architecture. It was quite amazing. Her work deals with pranks. It's when pranks go wrong. So where I'm looking at this, you know, you can see it with those conceptual underpinnings, but you can also see it formally and how it dwarfs scale. It changes things in incredible ways, and just a little breeze will animate it as well. And I'll point out this little pod in the corner of our yard is by the Danish artist N55. They kind of come in and out of existence, but if you go to N55, just Google it, you'll see the project Land, their Land project. And these Karens are installed in Greenland, in Northern California, in South America, and they basically denote free land. So being good socialists from Denmark, for the most part, one is Norwegian, they do not believe in ownership of land. So these things exist, and you're supposed to be able to do whatever you want. And if you open that little portal, you'll see one of their pamphlets. And they also don't believe in authorship of the project. So if you go to their website, there's manuals for everything that they build, you too can build. So it kind of breaks down in terms of budget and materials as well. So they're an interesting group. Excuse me. Jean Dunning, I saw Jean yesterday. I'm working on a project at the Hyde Park Arts Center, curating a show that'll open in 2 weeks called Study in Midwestern Appropriation, and I'm including Jean. Jean here is installing an inflatable thumb. We can see that. We can see the details and so forth on top of the roof of the Suburban. And this was during the election season, so the idea was this kind of civic support, thumbs up, you know, to be part of, you know, this process. But Jean positioned it in a way where one didn't understand when they were walking by on the street that it was that part of the body, that it could be something else. So it has this almost dreidel-like effect. It has a handle-like effect. What he did like about it, again, is what it did to scale of this kind of cube-like structure. And the word autumn on the door was a remnant from Kay Rosen, who is a linguist artist who deals with text. And she did one of the first projects with us. Andrew Sattel, and sometimes artists, you know, we have these two spaces, but sometimes artists, when they're invited, choose to work in the house, in the yard, in the grocery store across the street. So some artists think outside of the context of the white spaces. And here, Andrew Sattel turned our house, our living room, into a smock shop, and these were the smockers that came out for the exhibition. You know, and we just kind of cleared out some of the furniture and had a couple of racks in which her smocks were exhibited. One, I suppose, could have bought them. Nobody did, but there was a lot of trying on. They're pretty amazing. Unfortunately, her smock shop project doesn't exist anymore. It came to a close. And now the poor farm. So that's the suburban. So in 2008, I'm from Wisconsin. We have we bought some land up there where I grew up. It's northeastern Wisconsin. It's very near Green Bay. And we built a studio. And across the county highway, it was this poor farm. It was always there. I grew, like I said, because I grew up in that part of the country, my grandfather would go to see an Uncle Joe, which we never had at the old the poor farm. But poor farms weren't poor farms then. They were old folks' homes. So a little quick history about the poor farm. And maybe you have them in Texas. They're in every state, including Canada. And it's a progressive social system that kind of bubbled up in around 1850, a little bit before that, as a progressive way to deal with those who had no means, those who were indigent, those who had no home. It was not acceptable. You were thrown into jail or you're sold off into a kind of indentured slavery. So the idea, riffing off of the almshouses, the British almshouses, where one would be an inmate at these poor farms in rural in the country, or poor houses if it was a city situation, an urban situation, one had to work the land in the poor farm. Again, you're an inmate. There is a jail in the basement, and it's not a debtor's prison. It's basically for being misbehaved on the poor farm. Women, there was a few women who would manage the kitchen for the most part, but they were first-generation immigrants, mostly from, in our poor farm anyways, from Northern Europe. There's a graveyard in the back, and you can see, if just by kind of finding, you can see a handful of people who will die in, 1894. Disease was going through at that time. So this is the poor farm. When the Social Security Act came into play in 1935, they became old folks' homes, as I was saying. And then they were sold off into private hands. So the guy was a truck driver when we bought it in 2008. We spend our summers up in Wisconsin. We spend our summers in the studio. How do we then, again, attach what we love to our lives, right? Kind of make it easy for us. How do we bring artists to us? We're able to bring artists from all over the world to the suburban. I don't know if I would have even been able to think that way now, but we certainly did when we started in 99. How do we do that? How do we even bring people further to rural Wisconsin where there's no airport, no public transportation? Transportation at all. So we decided to do this programming, and it's been quite successful since 2009. This was our fifth year, and I want to tell you that if you go to New York right now, the Kitchen, a very important performance space in Chelsea, is hosting an exhibition that we organized last year called Tracking the Thrill. It's an artist named Gretchen Bender, who died in 2004. She was partners with Robert Longo, and she used TV as a medium. So we developed this exhibition. We brought together her television performances. We did a lot of research. We got a Warhol grant, and we developed this content that New York actually wanted. It's kind of a great thing, folks, when you can be in off-center and be able to generate content that the center wants, right, that it goes back. So it's a hugely, we're very proud of the moment. We produced a catalog. So this is kind of a great thing where one can actually think about these spaces and do something and be able to recognize the center becomes, and again, I can talk about New York. They don't even recognize that there's another place. I mean, they really don't. It's not malicious. They just are so blindsided in terms of their own production, their own institutions. But watching and participating in New York, I'm not saying that you should never leave Fort Worth or Dallas. You got to see what's going on, but you can also see the blind spots, and those blind spots you can produce somewhere else. And that's what's really great. You just have to watch all the time. So that's an example of Bender. A couple projects that happened. This was the very first year. An artist from Baltimore, who's really a sculptor, who's very interested in where bodies touch other bodies, decided to drive a saddle maker, a very prominent saddle maker, from Baltimore all the way to the poor farm. There's a lot of horses in our neck of the woods up there, and gave saddle demonstrations, saddle fitting demonstrations. So that happened. There's some performance. David Robbins, this fellow that keeps popping up. Interesting piece where he created this, kind of like a squatter's mat, except it has this little Harlequin surfacey thing going on. But then it's scattered with candy bar wrappers, which are $100,000 bars, payday, all those things that are absolutely incongruent to the idea of a poorhouse. Another artist, Stephanie Barber from Milwaukee, it's poetry that she was able to kind of pull out and create in the yard. Olivier Mose, a well-known, he splits his time between New York, Switzerland, and the Southwest, a monochrome artist. He was in the biennial not too long ago, where these large canvases, these monochromes, are basically, brings them to the auto body shop, so they have this kind of auto body finish to them. Chris Barandio. Chris Barandio teaches at Rice down in Houston. And Chris went to school with my husband Brad at University of Illinois in Chicago. And Chris is interesting. He came up with the idea and he sold it to MTV, of one of those first reality art TV shows. And, you know, Chris is so interesting, really dealing with, the social underpinnings of art production. And he contacted us and said, you know, I lost my muse. You know, here I got this tenure track teaching job at Rice, kind of sold my soul and my ideas to MTV. And you know, I have to kind of regenerate and restart. So he said, I want to come up to the Poor Farm for the summer, if you don't mind, and look at clouds. And these are clouds. This is what he saw in the clouds. I think his muse is still lost. Okay, so those are examples of things that are going on at the Poor Farm. If you come and visit us now, Lucio Pozzi, who is an 85-year-old Italian man, taught at a taught in New York for years at a School of Visual Arts. He spent the summer with us, along with another artist named Lars Walter, and then there's some other curatorial projects going on. And what's different, as I was saying before, the suburban, our exhibitions flip every 6 to 8 weeks. The Poor Farm exhibitions last for a whole year. So any chance you're going to be in the Midwest the first week in August, it's always the first week in August, we have our openings. We have a free school, a summer school that happens with institutions from all over the Midwest as well. And those exhibitions last through June, so they last over the course of the year. I'm showing you here David Robbins, the guy who had the sack and the candy bar wrappers and the studio in the office. This is an example of an artist who can't escape his albatross. This is the piece David Robbins did in 1986. It's called Talent. And you'll recognize some of these people, Cindy Sherman, Jeff Koons, including Gretchen Bender, Tracking the Thrill, that exhibition I was telling you about. She's next to David Robbins in the lower right-hand corner. He's in the lower right-hand corner because that's where the signature of a piece would be, so it's important that he's there. Tom Lawson, he is a dean at CalArts, Ellen McCollum, Ashley Bickerton, a lot of these guys, Robert Longo, you recognize them all. But so he had all of his friends. These were friends that were associated with a gallery called Nature Mort in the East Village in New York. At the time, it was the other. So you had the Basquiat, the Herring, the neo-expressionists. Like those are the funky people affiliated with Gracie Mansion Gallery. And then you had the intellectuals, and that's what these guys were. So David just invited them all to come and have their headshots taken in Times Square. So that's this piece. There's an edition of 100. This happens to hang in our living room. David gave us a piece, and you see them. You'll go to a Jeff Koons show somewhere, and the museum will pull these out as didactic material, so you can get you can see a young Jeff Koons. So I curated a show at Marianne Boesky Gallery last year called 25 Years of Talent. So if I had to, vacuum under this suite of artists who I studied closely in the late 80s, and swifter dust their frame for the last 10 years, I had to hold them accountable. So what I ended up doing is, like I said, Gretchen Bender is dead and so is Stephen Prino. So I had to borrow work, but everybody else, I got new work. Like, what are they doing now? Who are they? And, it's very interesting in terms of, and you talk to some of these artists who you wouldn't recognize, maybe Ellen Belcher, who now lives in Toronto, but who ran Nature Mort at the time. You know, there's hard feelings. A lot of these guys really don't like David Robbins, I learned. So there's all this interesting dynamic that happens. But it's also a curious study in terms of success, right, and influence. Was their work any better in 1986 and over the arc of the years than somebody else? What's going on? So in terms of even me being up here and talking about influence, again, very modestly, I hope. My reach isn't big. I just work hard. Same thing, you got to think about all these artists as well. Okay, so now with that, we're going to segue into my work. Somebody I mentioned earlier is Friedrich Froebel, the German philosopher who invented the tenets of kindergarten. He created these things called gifts, 13 gifts, and one of them is paper weaving, and I'll show you some of my paper weaving Another, you know, just spheres. The idea, things before words, right? Before one starts to understand the abstraction and the complexities of complex thought, one has to hold something in their hand. One has to identify it with its color. He was really interested in gardening, setting forth ideas, you know, kids being out gardening. And nature, the natural world, was very important to him. So he created these gifts, right? The idea of a sphere and what happens when you kind of rotate it. You can feel its centrifugal force around your finger. And this is how you know the properties of the world before language starts to come in. And this is something, I took this photograph, something that my kids did while I was making pancakes in the morning. And this is kind of an example of that. Tony Fair, the artist who did the tape, you know, this could be confused for a Tony Fair tape piece. He often uses marbles. But the idea of, you know, balancing marbles on an egg carton and looking at the difference between what is transparent and what is opaque, what is smooth, what is, you know, what kind of falls apart, and kind of, you know, just giving pause to what this is. You know, pancakes were done, marbles went back to the marble jar, and, you know, the egg carton was recycled. But to have those moments, to be able to identify these kind of formal things that come together just in the everyday is really important. And again, Tony Fair, this is Tony Fair, does that. That is his practice. And this was a show that he did at Pace. He just moved galleries. I want to say he's at Sikkim & Jenkins right now. But this was a show he did at Pace where, again, going to the hardware store, buying, you know, vinyl clear tubing and filling it with colored water. And what do we have here? You know, it's really hard to backfill this with any kind of conceptual underpinning that's not formal, right? It's about yellow. It's about line. It's about looping line. It's about the limits of what this tubing, this, you know, plumbing material can do. It's about the transparency. What happens to this yellow if you revisit the show at the end of the run of the show where the yellow starts to fade a little bit? So it really is starting to deal with, you know, it just deals with those things that are familiar to us. And, you know, I respect those things. I make those part of my practice when I can. Maria Montessori, her teaching tools. Again, the idea of coming to math, the concepts of math through touch, through color. Sheila Hicks, somebody I have an enormous respect for. Sheila Hicks went to Yale as a painter in the 50s and worked with Elbers. And she, at one point, made one of her stretchers into a loom, and that was it. And she started traveling to Mexico. And so she's known in the fiber circle as, you know, quite a lioness. But, you know, just, again, pulling her out of, you know, the very, very complicated discourse of craft and the hierarchy between craft and fine arts, all that aside, you know, just thinking about it in terms of simple vocabulary. And these are some of her early but also real simple studies in terms of material studies and graphic studies. This is her diagonal. They're amazing. There was a show that traveled to the ICA in Philly. I want to say it originated maybe in Harvard. I'm not quite sure. And here she's making a loom out of the bottom of a chair frame. And this is an example of some of the paper weaving. So when I'm telling you I'm embracing Froebel and some of these very simple tenets, I'm not at all interested in invention. I don't go to the studio and say, what can I invent today? What kind of image? But the idea of going through a kind of routine, something that's found. So paper weavings, you know, I've been installing them on the floor, but recently I've been installing them on a plinth because I thought it was a little too overdetermined to put paper on the floor. So that was just a decision I made. So I do this on a regular basis. Oops, excuse me. The paper weavings are something that I'll go into the studio and do as a studio exercise, as a way of kind of understanding, again, a kind of basic vocabulary, and to understand that no matter how conceptually complex I can get with my work or how formal or material I can stay, that this is the underpinning of all that trajectory. Okay, so that's one foundation to my studio practice. Another foundation I was saying earlier is the idea of curiosity, but also curiosity in relationship to the aesthetic of wonder, right? We all know the sublime. We understand its vastness, its unknowableness. But the aesthetic of wonder is something that we can understand. It gives us pause. It gives us great beauty. But we're able to kind of parse it. We understand that when we see that rainbow in the distance, and it really, it's a good one, we're looking out the window. But we also understand the direction that that storm is going and the direction of the sun, right? So through a kind of basic knowledge, we understand how this thing came to be. So what I was doing is looking at spectrums, the idea of spectrum and usually using flock in this case and pumping flock onto a wall. And then at the end of the show, it all just kind of dissolves. You just vacuum the whole thing up. And then in addition to the idea of the rainbow, the spectrum, which a lot of artists are drawn to, we're drawn to it because it's simple beauty. It's one of these things that are inherent in kind of the human condition. We're drawn to this all light, right? The kind of all light. You know, being in Wisconsin, my parents live near Green Bay, and you know, after a big snowstorm, they gather, you know, the roofs just gather the snow, and it's like buying a new piece of Arches paper, like the potential of it. So the idea, this is, it's all fake. I went through and made photographs and then hand-painted them, but I was trying to spray paint them, and to no good success. I would always, the body, this, it's always the fool's game. The body would fall into the snow. It would imprint on the snow. You know, when you're dealing with the ideal, the platonic ideal, the body, the material world always comes into play. So one had to go to illusion. And speaking of illusion, again, a really good example of curiosity and wonder. This is Fischl and Weiss's piece. What you're seeing here is just, you know, those plastic cheap wine glasses that, you know, when you go to an opening, wine is served in. And Fischl and Weiss just projected a light through it, and it was on this little clumsy turntable. And amazing things happened through the kind of spectrum and the facet of the plastic cup. And it just kind of rocks in an interesting way. And this is an exhibition at the Walker that included one of my silver points, and I'll talk about the silver points in a bit. But it was a show that kind of was built around these gestures, these kind of marvelous little gestures of materiality. Let me look at my time here. I'm going to speed up. That's the talent. That's where it is. No, maybe not. Okay, this is a photograph by the Blumas. Unfortunately, Mr. Bluma Gerhardt, I think his name is, he died. But the Blumas are a German photography team, not to be confused with the Beckers. Beckers? Yes. Sorry. I looked at the clock. The Blumas, what they're doing is, what they did is they spent a lot of their focus on undercutting the middle class Germans, right? The idea that the potato, the kind of the base of the middle class German class order, is based on something as stable as the potato. And what would happen if the potatoes went out of control? Like, what would go on there? So this is what's happening here. So in a way, it's a little cruel. Their project is cruel. But at the same time, one also understands the value of the middle class, particularly Germans. I mean, there's some images of, you know, Germans on holiday in the Black Forest, which is devastated by acid rain, right? But the Germans themselves, they're all happy because they're on holiday. So this is an example of the work that they ended up doing. But I show this to you not... I am a fan, but because my potatoes can't do this. I can't do all those things that Terry was so kind to list if, you know, the domestic situation, if I don't have my potatoes in the bowl. So I show you this, and this is a lead up to the paintings. Also on Kawara is somebody very important, the idea of counting, day-to-day time. Again, the subject of boredom. You know, I will not make any more boring art. You know, he says this with a little wink, wink. Baldessari is not opposed to that space in boredom in which one can work, because clearly he did not only an installation in which he wrote that again and again and again and had to himself be bored, but has also made other work around that. So early on, when I came out of school, my domestic situation and my painting practice were very tight, and they had to be. I had two young kids. I had a studio in the basement. So what does one paint after nearly a decade of being educated in a school? One goes to that which is close, the backdrop, the thing that is behind. So this is the 90s. It's a long time ago, folks. There was not a lot of painting going on in the 90s. You know, one was thinking about representation in the 90s. One was thinking of Felix Gonzalez Torres, Rear Criteria Venezia. I mean, this was the practice we were looking to. So painting seemed odd. It seemed hard to get a grasp of. So I just went to what was behind me. So you're going to, I'll just run through a handful of these paintings. They're enamel on panel. You know, they're moderate in size. Thinking about abstraction, thinking about the authority of abstraction in relationship to the always contentious lack of authority of the domestic space. space, and so forth, and having these things come together, thinking about the field, thinking about women's work. So all of these things were coming together. Car beads. I don't see car beads in cars anymore, but some of us who are my age can remember those ridiculous car beads. And what was happening here, again, not invention, not kind of hand-drawn. These are indexes. So again, being schooled in the 80s, and kind of going to, when I was showing you that talent piece, being more informed and drawn to those artists as opposed to the neo-expressionists, the other school that was happening in the 80s. So it was very difficult for me to, even though, in high school it was fine, to load a brush and touch a canvas. Like, I could not do that. So the idea of indexing. So I would take these things. In this case, you're looking at a crocheted blanket. You can recognize the pattern. Stretch a blanket over a panel. Spray through it. You get the notation. You get the negative. And then going back in and filling in, right? A kind of boring process going on. In this case, this is a flocked panel where I was pumping flock then into the wet enamel. So it's really fuzzy. It has this kind of fuzzy surface. So massive amounts of these while I was a young mom and doing a lot of teaching. Galen Gerber, the platform artist, platformist that I was talking about, either parasitic artist or generous artist, he has this project where he calls it Galen Gerber With. So he has his backdrops in which people hang work on, but he also creates these 40 by 40 inch canvases that he paints gray on Belgium linen and gives them to other artists to make work. So in this case, I made a handful of the flocked daisy patterned pattern on his works. And you can see, it's important to see the process, right? They're not a perfect Cartesian grid. You actually see the materiality, the kind of stretch, what happens when the material goes over that support. This is just a detail of an installation shot of an exhibition I did at Cranbrook where I made backdrops for their modern chair collection. So I was doing this for a long time. And just quickly, a little bit of an anecdote here. I was really looking for order. I was looking for organization, right? I had two young kids. I was teaching part-time. I was starting to write. How does one, again, acquire influence? One has to work really hard. So I needed order. The potatoes could not start to float around in the air. So the canvas, the paintings that I was showing you previous, did represent a kind of order. But in critical circles, the work was always being framed as women's work. And, it's funny from this perspective. I would welcome that now in an instant. At the time, it felt weak to me. I understood that it was there. I knew it was there. But at the same time, I needed it to be more masculine, quite honestly. I needed more distance, more objectivity out of those paintings. So I abandoned that project completely, and I started to make these small little dots. I still need repetition. I still need the idea of time consumption. I still need to create conditional boredom in the studio. So I go to another motif, since I'm not interested in making it up, and that's an Archimedes spiral. So these are large canvases. The 80 inches is the largest because I can still reach to the center in an 80-inch diameter, and then they go down to about 20 inches. So I find the center, and I start to rotate, right? So an Archimedes spiral, all the legs of the spiral are of equal distance, and when the point falls off the edge, the painting is done. And again, what I was saying before when we were looking at the photographs, the rainbow photographs in the snow, the spectrums in the snow, the material world will always, when I start narrowing down my system, right, this is just flash on black gesso on canvas. When your system starts to close down, the body, the material world starts to be fairly dramatic. So every time you see these kind of rotations, I'm leaving to pick up my daughter. I come back. The points get closer together. The material, my paint evaporates slightly. My brush starts to wear down. So it's inevitable that the material world will start to imprint and kind of measure that time and what happens in time. Tara Donovan, this is mean of me. I put this in here because she had a show at Pace. It was the same time Tony Fair was in one Pace space and she was in the other. And these are they're incredible. I show these to you because I want to be critical, but I will have to acknowledge that they're incredible. These are I would say they're 6x6, if not larger than that, and they're all that little gradation that you see, heads of pins. There's heads of pins, right? So she creates this kind of gradation through this accumulation of pins, straight pins, and so forth. Tara Donovan, I hope you know her work. She has received a Genius Award. Is about accumulation, right? What happens when you buy billions and billions of Q-tips and you pile them up? It's incredible. It's just incredible on a material base. It also talks about consumption, materiality, manufacturing, and so forth. So I'm kind of cruel with these because I think they're arbitrary, right? She's here where I'm, you know, even though my spirals may seem arbitrary, they're not. They're very specific in terms of not being, you know, creating a motif that one doesn't invent. Here, you know, she's kind of creating product for the marketplace because it's really hard, except for crazy institutions, to smack down a lot of money for Q-tips, right? So here she's creating, you know, the stuff of inventory. So I was really hard on her in terms of, like, what are these compositions? Yes, they're amazing feats of, you know, material adjustment, but, you know, I'm not quite sure they are these why they're these conical forms. So anyways, being critical, and I'll just keep walking here. A studio shot, and you can kind of get a sense, again, it's funny because when you're close to them, you know, some people get nauseous. I mean, there's a lot of information, but you don't get to see the rotation. You don't get to see the rings of the tree almost. And then when you pull away, you can start to see them. This is an exhibition in London at Rocket Gallery. So I'm continuing to do those. Just finished one happily. It take a long time. So one finished. But the body, at some point a handful of years ago, while one was thoroughly throwing oneself into these little dots, the body needed to do something else. I just needed to have a different kind of athletic move. But again, thinking about a found composition. And in this case, you know, something that's radial. So these are silver points. So again, it's black. They're very textural. Like, this work went from, you know, what was recognizable, readable signifiers, the domestic, to almost text, right? It's black and white. So silver point on black gesso paper and just kind of raking it. What's kind of great about the silver point, though, is it tarnishes. So it almost has, almost feels a little bit like a silver print. It'll start to really warm up and vignette. And then silver point on panel. This is with Wendy White and Mary Heileman in a show, I think, in, I want to say Bemis. Bemis is in Nebraska. This is an exhibition of the silver points and the paintings. Very different, excuse me, very different vocabularies. Like, one can't square them up, I mean, in terms of the point paintings and this, but the body needed to do it. It was something that had to happen in the studio. And the colored canvases are Jeremy Gilbert Rolfe, who is a LA-based artist. And head of the grad program at Art Center. And then at the same time, you know, I was thinking about the studio when the foundation of our economy was being pulled away. I just thought that we could pull the foundation of exhibition and display away and start throwing these things, pull them off the wall and throw them into a kind of orbit. So I started working with my husband again and making these collages. These mobiles. I'm sorry about that. So my husband and I are working together on these mobiles, kind of engineering these big things. And a matter of fact, we're engineering suspending bleachers at the MoCA in Cleveland. In the 90s, we were collaborating with our kids. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip over this collaborative work with my husband so we can get to questions. So those things that I just walked through fairly quickly, we were working on those while I was working on a lot of that domestic painting. So those things were, again, it's 90s, thinking about narrative and so forth. This is an exhibition thinking about mobiles being produced in contemporary art right now. It was at White Flags in St. Louis. And my piece is the bleacher section up there with the tondos, the two-sided tondos. Here you go. This is a show at Leo Koenig Gallery in Chelsea a couple years ago. And again, thinking about bringing other people in, like, what happens when, you know, you create this kind of magnet, when other work starts to be pulled to it. So it didn't move the way a lot of the mobiles prior, but the idea of attaching and being able to see backside of my own work as well as the work of other artists. So we're curating, and your own work start to collapse. Again, thinking about a platformist position. So that's an 80-inch dot painting. You're seeing the back of it, and the whole thing is suspended through this Van Doesburg-like construction. But the back of I'm becoming really interested in what the back can accumulate. So in this case, it accumulates my daughter's chair, one of my silver points, one of my husband's painting, a photograph from the house. So I call this my oyster work, right? So you can still, you know, see and appreciate the accumulation of time in the front, but then you get another time, another kind of narrative that's on the backside as it rotates. And here's a detail. This is a piece that we put together in San Francisco, and we're reconvening it for the survey show in Cleveland. And the whole thing is weighted by these old Mercedes body parts. I had this Cold War Mercedes that started with a glow plug. I love this car. It just rusted away. So then earmarking some of these pieces as support in terms of supporting the painting. In addition, this is a tricky thing, and I'm still coming to terms with it. The whole thing was weighted with this footlocker, and this footlocker, as you all know, has a lot of narrative potential to it, right, as a signifier, the idea that a dead body, something is in it. So if you see those other components, even if you're looking at the Mercedes fenders, what you're seeing is something that's been formalized. And here, even painting a footlocker orange doesn't pull it out of its referent quite enough. I think I stepped too far into narrative here. And then I'm just going to close with some gingham pattern. So what's happening is I'm kind of creeping back to, very slowly, to some of those references to domestic fabric, the idea of gingham, the idea of weaving. So I'm kind of going back and asking myself, what does it mean? My two older boys are grown. I still have a daughter who will be 9 very soon. My domestic situation, I'm not kind of slogging it out, teaching part-time here and there. A tenure-track job, these other things have stabilized. What does that mean to look then at the signifiers of the domestic? Am I being nostalgic? That's a possibility. But I'm starting to kind of creep back and starting to think about what that can mean again. So there's this kind of return. And, quite honestly, I'm hankering for a little color. This is copper points. These are all metal point on, this is gold point, actually. Gold point is not the most interesting metal point because it stays inert. Silver point starts to warm up and actually starts to really blacken. Copper, which I've used, starts out pink and becomes brown. But gold, albeit more value than the other metals, ends up being that. And I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with that. I rushed at the end because I do want to make time for questions. Thank you. The Whitney. Don't you guys want to know about the Whitney? The biennial? Yeah. Oh, sure. I'm sorry I rushed by. That's my favorite work. So my husband and I, we moved from Chicago. We both got our MFAs in Chicago. We moved to Milwaukee because it was less expensive. One could get a part-time job. But it was also 92. So again, as I was saying, Felix Gonzalez-Torres, Rickert Tervenige, who we just happened to, we knew. I mean, Felix came over. He had his first museum show at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and we hosted him. And he was important to us. And, so it's this kind of narrative thinking that, my husband was a painter too, so how do we participate in the art world when painting, that thing that we were doing in school, didn't have that kind of value? It wasn't part of the discourse. So we decided to deal with, what we had, and that was this young family, and we asked questions about our kids. What's kind of great about it is, some of the projects that we came up with, they kind of solved themselves, right? I mean, as the kids' behavioral, if you have kids, they change, and so they solve themselves. But really, it was a call for kind of help. Like, what do you do when, my kid just wants to read Goosebumps all the time? So we bought tons of Goosebumps and made stacks of them in the gallery, like a Felix Gonzalez-Torres giveaway. So that's what we were doing. We're just mirroring the discourse and the form of art of the 90s onto, our family life. And, I enjoy looking at it now because I like to think about back to the kids, but, it wasn't anything that wasn't being done in New York in terms of art practice. Yeah. Well, the kids were. The kids, different subject, different form, same. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Just to answer your question, to ask a question about the Whitney, the Whitney is semi-unique in sort of having this sort of nationalist perception about sort of American art, and I'm wondering how you think about Americanism related to the...
Well, you know, the institution doesn't know how to think about it. So the Whitney Biennial started in the 70s. Before that, it was the annual, where every other year it would be painting and then sculpture and painting and sculpture. And, you know, since then, biennials are popping up everywhere, right? So what was the only biennial in the world, let alone in the States, we see all over the place. So that's really changing how institutions or what the Whitney Biennial is. You know, the biennial right now, I mean, if you track the biennial in the last 10 years, curatorially it's responding to curatorial trends and not trends in American practice, right? It went through its kind of hot curator time, right? You had Francesco Bonomi or Philippe Verne, right? And then you had the group curatorial bits. So you can really track the curatorial industry. You're not tracking what... to some degree, those curatorial conceits framed what they thought American art was, but always very differently. And you see Europeans included in the biennial all the time. You will perhaps see a Canadian included on the fourth floor. I'm doing the fourth floor. And just as an aside, to just cut right to the structure, which is very different, very unique this year. It potentially will be the last biennial in the Breuer Building. That's where how we've come to know and love the Whitney Museum. They're moving downtown, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art is moving into the Madison Street Building. Amazing. And that is so exciting to me. It'll mess with all the institutional heads in New York. So this year, potentially the last biennial year, because the museum, after 7.5 years, could move back into the space, three curators, we each get a floor. So what's important to me about that is that the curating, the curatorial industry will be seen. You will see my selection, you will see Stuart Cromer, my colleague's selection, and you'll see Anthony Elm's selection. And I only do that because that's our floors. I'm not elevating anything that's not about floor, the floor plan. So that's really interesting because curators have huge amounts of authority and reign right now. And curatorial programs are popping up as we speak. We all got three notes on eFlux saying there's a new curatorial studies program popping up in Berlin in a couple weeks. So to see that and to make that part of the content is really important. So in terms of America, how I see America, you know, I wish the project was that clear that... That's the thing that I could embrace. But it's a funny combination of institutional desire, budget, my other curators, time frame. Like, all of these things really come to define it. I was telling Terry earlier, and this is the thing that as an artist, I'm curating as an artist because that's what I am. I'm not an institutional curator. And so as an artist, I've been into studios everywhere. You know, there's parts of the Southeast that I didn't hit that I feel I just wish I had more time, that I'm not getting to. But I'm going into studios, and the trend in curating is not to go into studios. Professional curators are going into fewer and fewer studios. It's alien to many of them. And instead, what curators are doing, and my colleagues are doing this to a greater degree. I didn't even know it was a possibility, but they would approach you and say, "Give me a proposal. I've seen your work. Make a proposal." And that's, as an artist, I think that's a little problematic because I may not be very good at thinking that way. I would like you as a curator to see my space, the things that I do, those materials, some of that thinking I was talking about. I think that's really important. But that's a trend in curating that's curious. I push back at it a little bit, and then the curators snap back at me. It's interesting. The example, my negative critical example, kind of poking at curators, was that if I asked Terry to give me a proposal, and Terry decides to make this installation. She doesn't work in installation form, but she makes this installation that's multi-channel video. I get to take a lot of credit for that shift, right? So it's a funny collaboration in a way, and it keeps curators in play with the idea of thinking and making and working. You know, I don't want to stand up here and support, you know, that other kind of curator as steward of artist work only. I mean, there's so much in between, and, you know, that's not going anywhere. But yeah, I guess I was surprised that that's a process. So, you know, I'm dodging your question in all kinds of ways. I can tell you that I've been to studios from San Diego to Portland. I've been in Texas. I've been through the Midwest. I've been in New York. I'm not negating New York, just because I don't come from there. You know, Chicago, Florida, Georgia. So I've been all over the place. But I still think, you know, inevitably I missed something. I can tell you, though, you know, hopefully you all get to see it. I'm being very forthcoming in the catalog. I'm basically having info charts made of all the where I've been in terms of the studios, male, female, the gender breakdown, race breakdown, age breakdown. I'm just going to give you the information. I'm going to be as transparent as possible because, as an artist, I've been visited by curators in the past, biennial curators in the past, and it's always kind of sketchy. Like they don't say, "Hey, I'm doing research for the biennial." I just kind of know that's why they're asking. Then you never hear from them again. And then at some point in the fall, you realize, "Oh, the list is coming out. I'm not on that list." And you know, when you ask a curator, they're trying to protect you. It's very curious. The curators are like, you know, fragile artists. We just don't want to give them too much information. And I think that's ridiculous. I think that I want to be as forthcoming as possible. And thus, my essay in the catalog will be peppered with, you'll know exactly what I did. And, you know, and then get over it, right? I mean, this is the thing, right? And so instead of, you know, saying that, you know, she had two more men than women, and that'd be the conversation, deal with the art, you know, deal with what I put in there. So that was another interest that, you know, we always have the bean counters, and, you know, I'll count the beans for you and then make a call. So. Oh, yeah, yep, and then I'll go there.
Has the process that the Suburban involved, like from the early days to now, the selection of artists, the awareness and things like that, how has that worked, or how has it changed? If it has.
Yeah, it has. It has. I mean, as I was saying, there was this little policy. Oh, maybe I didn't say this. I think I alluded to it, but there was a kind of made up a policy where we didn't show Chicago-based artists. We were for a while, and then it was getting too uncomfortable in terms of, you know, being pushed or pressed by, you know, former students or colleagues of mine, and try to get away from that kind of odd conflict of interest. So we just looked to the outside. You know, I think what has happened is that, you know, what happened, you know, I don't take unsolicited proposals. Like, you have to be there. You have to understand that there's a dog running around in the yard in you know, the situation with the kids. I mean, this is not a typical exhibition space. They're tiny. The spaces are tiny. I can't tell you how many times, you know, artists come and, you know, who maybe had, you know, I don't know, have been watching the Suburban for a while, and they still gasp. They know it's small, but they gasp when they walk in the space because it's so small. So people really have to kind of come and understand it and know it. You know, now it seems like I'm kind of managing, though. I have to say that I'm not in a particularly good spot where it seems like I'm programming so far out. And, you know, that's because of the other projects that are going on. I'm really looking forward to become closer to it. So right now I just seem like I'm a doty administrator of it. And I'm not, you know, I'm not thinking about what everybody's interesting. Everybody who comes is, you know, challenging to me and giving me something to think about. But I'm letting that happen as a course of scheduling, as opposed to selection, where I'm thinking, I'd really like to see what this person is about. Let me reach out to them. I'm being more defensive in its organization right now, and I'm looking forward to being more offensive in terms of how it's programming. And that's just, again, it's just with what's going on in my life and my husband's life right now. Yeah.
I'm curious if the sort of mindless, repetitive, programmatic nature of the process of your work is what, in part, allows you to have a head full of so many other things.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have said that. That is exactly spot on right. I couldn't be social. I couldn't be out here in the world if I didn't have that, very classical studio where the door is shut. I mean, I often put on bad television, but that's about it. I mean, nothing else comes in there. So, that repetitive nothingness allows me to go out into the social scary world of people. They have to be balanced, otherwise I couldn't do it. Things get out of balance, right? All of a sudden I'm working to a show, and that starts to creep up, and then right now I'm in this funny spot where it's all too muchness. But the survey show is really helping me get through the biennial, right? It's ridiculously set high, but it's both of those two parts, the studio practice and the other kind of critical practices involved. But yeah, I couldn't have said it better. Yeah.
Can you talk a little more about your critical, you as a writer, as a critic?
Yep, and Art Forum put me on a year hiatus, so when the biennial comes out, they can be critical of me and not feel like they have to defend one of their writers, which I miss. I really do miss writing those monthly reviews. They keep me looking at work that I maybe wouldn't have otherwise and critically assessing it. The writing is interesting. I've been doing a handful of catalog essays lately, and I do enjoy those. And one isn't necessarily critical. Those are research projects. And that's interesting. But the kind of criticality of writing, not kind of having that venue to do it because, again, I'm up for critical assessment. It's interesting to take a pause from that. And that may be, I may be, directing some of my criticality into not artwork and artists, but into the institution and curating, right? So I've seen that shift when, we're not able to make room for, critically going in, looking at and assessing work and exhibitions as a critic for our forum. I'm actually doing that, but directing that criticality somewhere else right now. And the result would be something like those input charts, like trying to be, forthcoming with that, doing, yeah.
Hi. I want you to talk about, for you, the quality of boredom. Like, what if can you put words to the quality of boredom? Because it's a luxury, right? Like, that is sort of a
It is. It's very difficult, and you're maybe trying to call me out on it. And it should be right. Somebody else's boredom is somebody else's meditation, right? I mean, there's one can unpack it in different ways. It's a kind of situational boredom. It's not always pleasant, right? I mean, it's not. I'm not kind of going into the studio and zoning out. It still has to pay attention, right, to what is going on. And that's the irritant. One can't give over completely because one would not be able to maintain a spiral. So at what point, it's this funny balance between paying attention to not be able to go into a totally fantastical space or another space,